It's bad, this drought. And this week we got more numbers to show it. There are these categories laid out by what's known as the U.S. Drought Monitor. There's severe, there's extreme, and the worst is exceptional. I mean, severe is bad enough, but the Division of Water Resources announced late this week that pretty much the entire state, 99.94% of Utah, is now in those top categories, extreme and exceptional. And compare that to last year. Last year, only 1% of the state, 1% was extreme. There wasn't anywhere in the exceptional category. So far, people seem to be coping, but when things get exceptional, it makes it seem like we're on the knife's edge and things could happen. No one seems to be panicking, but if you want to know what a water panic looks like, check out the story of Cape Town, South Africa in 2017 and 2018. Water levels in dams and reservoirs in the city had dropped drastically, and city officials said they were just months away from what they called day zero, the day when you turn on a tap and nothing comes out. The journalist Brett Walton covered the story.
Cape Town found itself in the end of 2017, beginning of 2018, in pretty severe circumstances with water supply in its reservoirs. The scenario went from bad to extremely bad in January of 2018. That's when the mayor of Cape Town started messaging that there would be a point at which the city would cut off water to its residents. The day zero phenomenon. There was an initial panic. People hoarded water. I talked with people who said they were in the supermarket and people descended on the stockers when they put water bottles out even before they got to the shelves. It was like a Christmas shopping rush. There were people who queued for hours at natural flowing springs around the city to gather water in jars. There were people who paid people to stand in line to gather water at those springs. There was a widespread acknowledgement that serious measures had to be taken to prevent the city from what was unthinkable, shutting off water to people. And for a large city, you cannot function that way. It would have been chaos. And so thankfully, it didn't come to that. Once the day zero messaging came across, the residents of Cape Town finally started to cut their water use down to what was necessary to prevent that day zero scenario where water was shut off. But this was a city on the brink.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on drought. And like I said, we're not in the panic phase of this yet, but the story of Cape Town could tell us something about the future here in the West. We asked Walton to tell us what it was like there in Cape Town, and he said there's only so much you can do about the supply side of a water crisis. So what they did in Cape Town was focus on the demand.
We're talking very, very drastic cuts here. Eventually, Cape Town officials said that residents could use no more than 50 liters per person per day. And that equals 13 gallons per person per day.
Wow.
And if you are used to using 3, 4, 5, 6 times that amount of water or more, that is a pretty severe restriction. And that is a very drastic change in your lifestyle. And so what that means in practice is that you go into institutions like schools or universities or shopping malls or restaurants, the water in the bathroom does not run. They turned off the water faucets, had hand sanitizing stations instead. For residents, they couldn't wash cars or fill pools, no lawn watering. I rode around with cops who were on the water wasting beat and saw them bust up a few people for washing taxis, check in on people who appeared to be watering their lawns. And so for individuals, this meant that they really had to think about water perhaps for the first time. We use water for everything, almost everything in our lives. And when you reach that level of restriction to 13 gallons per person per day, then every toilet flush, every hand wash becomes something that you have to measure and consider in some sort of daily mental calculus. And studies have shown that the more decisions you have to make, the more mental strain you have. And for most people in the US and in wealthier cities, you don't have to think at all about water. It's there when you turn on the tap. It's something that blends into the background like air. So it's those sorts of mental calculations come into play at this level of restriction that are not present in, say, normal non-drought times.
This was fascinating. The panic, you say, was contained to the middle and upper classes. In other words, the low-income part of the city, those more in need, didn't freak out, certainly not in the same way. And so it exposed some of the social divides already present, I guess. Talk about that part.
Cape Town is a city divided in any circumstance between the wealthier folks who live in leafy green suburbs and live in nice houses, and people who live in what are called the informal settlements, places that are largely sprawling shanty towns far from the city limits. And in the informal settlements in 2018, the number was about 12% of those residents not having a household water connection. But for those residents, they had to queue for water at a community well on any day.
Yeah.
And so I heard from several of them that day zero had no resonance, had no meaning for them, because every day was a day zero. They didn't have any water at home to begin with. And that sort of division is not so stark in many American cities, not to the extent it is in Cape Town. But we do see unequal impacts of drought and crises in cities across the U.S. and across the West, where it is your social and economic status that determines how resilient you are. But the interesting thing in Cape Town is that the lack of water had kind of prepared or buffered or insulated some of the informal settlements from having to make such a drastic shift in their life, because they're already at that point.
So city leaders are telling residents day zero is approaching. How much of that was actually true? Would the water really have stopped flowing from the pipes at this particular moment?
If Cape Town residents in January had continued for the next few months to use water at the rate they were using it at the beginning of January 2018, then yes, they would have reached a point where they would have run out. They were using more than they had. And the day zero messaging was a hammer blow to move from pleading with residents to use less water to saying, in very stark terms, this is what happens if we don't reduce demand substantially.
So making people feel panicky about water, like on one hand, you'd think that would seem counterproductive, but on the other hand, making them realize this is serious, this is important, is could be good. I mean, it seems to have worked, I guess, that messaging, or is that right?
Yeah, it did work. So Cape Town did not reach day zero. Day zero was always a moving target. It was always based on how much water was being used that week, how much water was left in the dams. The messaging was criticized from some angles as being perhaps too harsh. Some business people said that it shook confidence in investment in the city, that the city might not have enough water for people to come into. But as an emergency measure, as an emergency communication measure, it worked. It had collateral damage, for sure. The entire situation had collateral damage that was unavoidable. But up until that, the day zero messaging, people, it hadn't sunk in.
Let's talk about the lessons that could be learned by others. Thinking, of course, about those of us here in the West. What are some of those? Maybe let's start with the idea of planning. You say that one lesson could be that cities need to start to look ahead, even consider these worst case scenarios. Talk a little bit about that part.
Yeah, planning is essential.
Yeah.
But carrying out plans is also essential. So I'll break down these two parts. The planning for Cape Town was there. There were representatives from local cities, from regional governments, from agricultural associations, from engineering firms that had been meeting for more than a decade to discuss Cape Town's water supply scenario. The discussions centered around how much water Cape Town would need and when Cape Town would need an additional water source. They were doing very, very precise calculations, looking at demand and how population was changing, and kind of mapping it out to the year when they thought they would need this new water source. And they kept pushing it back because they thought that they could effectively manage the city's demand. And that turned out to be not the case, because they got surprised by three consecutive dry years, the third of which in 2017 was extremely dry, 40% of normal. And that's the year that almost broke the city. So when planning, one of the things to look for is not just a narrow window, because the planning in Cape Town was looking at 60 to 80 years of climate records. And you need to really look farther than that, because these sorts of events do happen and have happened in the past. And if you don't look deep enough into the past, you can miss them. Climate change will make these things worse. Cape Town is expected to become drier as the planet warms. But the event that happened in 2016, 17, 18 was not out of the realm of possibility. And they didn't plan for that. Or they planned for that, but didn't execute on those plans. So even for low probability events, you need to be aware that they can have very serious consequences.
You also say another one of the lessons for communities dealing with droughts and continuing dry conditions is diversify. How does that work? The idea of looking for other sources, if you can find them, if you can get them.
Yeah, water supply planning in this case is like your financial planning. Diversify your portfolio, stocks and bonds and real estate, et cetera. You do the same with your water. You don't rely on one source, because that makes you brittle, that makes you fragile. That's what Cape Town found itself in as it went into this drought, is that it relied exclusively just about on reservoir systems, surface water, rainfall reservoir systems. They had a decent amount of storage capacity, enough for a couple years of storage. But when you get three consecutive dry years and your main source of water is rain, then you're going to be in a difficult situation. That's where Cape Town found itself.
I wonder if all of this says something about what you can control. If there's a drought, if water is depleted, not being replenished through the natural process, how much can you really manage? Can you control, conservation, policy, finding other sources? And how much of it is just out of your hands? Was that a lesson conveyed through this situation in Cape Town, do you think?
Nature varies. We have wet years and dry years. But the actions in Cape Town showed that people can use substantially less water if they need to. We have in the U.S. like a national average use of something like 83, 84 gallons per person per day. Cities in California, some are quite a bit lower than that, at 40 some gallons per day. Cape Town put in place a restriction to 13 gallons per day, and the people made it through. It was not comfortable.
Yeah.
It was not pleasant. People had to be conscious of their actions all the time around water, which you can do in an emergency situation, but it's taxing mentally and physically. So it showed that in times of crisis, you can get through it. The question is whether people are willing to do that for longer than 2 months or 3 months. And if we can put in place systems that allow for less use of water, but still maintaining comfortable lives, because that's what people want.
Yeah.
And those things are available and can be incorporated into homes, businesses, cities, regions, but it's going to take changes to get there. It's going to take investment in household recycling. It's going to take investment in diverse city water supplies. So we can have a water smart future and one that doesn't waste substantial amounts of water.
Brett Walton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Brett Walton. He's a reporter with the nonprofit Water Focus Newsroom, Circle of Blue. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're continuing our series on drought in the West today. We've been exploring the past, the present, and the future of drought. We're on part two today, the present. What we know is that nearly 100% of the state today is in the top two categories of drought, extreme and exceptional. And even further north, people are feeling these effects. Our producer, Benjamin Bombard, was in Box Elder County in June, and he's joining us here. And Ben, hi.
Hey, Doug.
So you went to Box Elder County to it's not really a city, a community called Park Valley, met a man named Royce Larson. Tell us about Royce.
So Royce Larson is the great-grandson of one of the original white settlers of the Park Valley area. And it's called that. It's called Park Valley because when Adam Larson, Royce Larson's great-grandfather, and other Mormon settlers first showed up in the mid-1800s, it was a very lush, verdant area. Mm. It was perfect for raising cattle. And I read one account of Park Valley that said that when the Mormon settlers first arrived there, the grass was so high that it reached up to your stirrups when you were on horseback. Mm.
But of course, things in Park Valley are different this year.
Yeah, that's right. Still very much a ranching community. That part hasn't changed. But it's gotten very, very dry. What was once a lush, verdant field at the base of the Raft River Mountains is now pretty much desert. Sagebrush and rabbit brush and low scrub. And the ranchers there depend on rain and snow runoff from the Raft River Mountains to take care of their cattle and their sheep and to water the fields that they use to grow the alfalfa to feed their animals throughout the harsh winter months. And that well seems to have run dry.
Yeah, we're in troubles as far as moisture, big time.
How so? What's going on?
We just didn't get no very little snow, and we haven't had no rain. I think we've had 2 inches of moisture since Christmas time.
Wow, that's it.
And so, I mean, these fields normally would be all full of green and starting to look like that lawn, and they're all burned up.
What does that mean for you guys?
Buy hay or sell cows, one or the other. Cows and sheep.
Are you in dire straits because of the drought? Are you pretty worried about it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So most years, Larson grows about enough hay on his fields to feed his 500,000 cattle, 1,500 sheep, through the winter months. This year, though, with as dry as it's been, that isn't happening.
We won't cut no hay.
Really?
Really. We're that short of water. I mean, we will not cut no hay.
All year?
No, no. And we usually cut, oh hell, 500 to 800 ton of hay a year, and we won't get nothing.
Have you ever had a year like that before?
It's been a long time. You know how you forget over the years, but this is about as dry as I ever remember it.
Wow. Huh.
I think back, the and I don't know why this sticks in my mind, but back in, I think, 61 or something, but I'd only been 11 years old, so, you know, but I remember Dad having to buy hay. We had milk cows then. They used to haul milk out of here, and I really think that's what the family lived on, you know, was that milk check, and he had to buy hay to feed them. Well, what cows we had, he bought all the hay that we fed, he had to buy, even through the summer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's pretty tough.
Okay, so that was about a month ago when you collected that tape. And you checked back in with Royce this week?
Yeah, I wanted to call him back up and just see how things were going.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Larson?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard. We met, I think it's about a month ago or so. I came up to your...
I remember.
You remember me? Okay.
Yeah.
How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. I wonder if you'd be interested in talking with me about, you know, what kind of decisions you've had to make since we last spoke and how things are going.
I mean, I haven't really made any major decisions as of yet because of it. I guess I've been stalling, but.
Did you end up cutting any hay?
We cut some, but we cut 10 bales off about, oh, I don't know, 20 acres or something was all we cut. And then that's them big round bales.
Mm-hmm.
Ton bales.
So how are the animals doing?
Well, we're all right on the mountains, yeah. In the mountains, I mean, like right above home here, it's caught a little bit of storm way high, way up in the top of it. And it's still fairly good, you know. I mean, we'll make it there till probably in the September, you know, if we're careful what we do.
When we last spoke, you mentioned that you foresaw facing the decision of whether to buy more hay or sell off cattle. What would those decisions mean for your livelihood and for your family?
My ranch is by no means paid for, you know, and if I sell my livelihood, then what the hell do I do? I got to buy them back or do something, you know. So, I mean, yeah, pretty devastating. There's three of us here living on this, and we'll be going to town to get a job, as it'll be.
Hmm.
A couple of months away from having to make a major decision, you know, as far as what we do with the cows, cows and sheep.
And what do they mean to you? I mean, like, what does ranching mean to you?
Well, it's my livelihood. I mean, I never ever wanted to do anything else. It's kind of like a doctor, you know. I enjoy what I do, and that's the only thing I ever wanted to do growing up. Is I wanted to ride a horse and, I guess, more or less be a cowboy in a sense. You know, I do farm, but I don't farm because I like it. I farm because I enjoy what goes with it, you know, because I have to do it to survive. This is my deal, and you'll say I'm probably crazier than hell, but I'm a survivor. I classify myself as a survivor. I'm 70 years old, and I've actually ranched since I was about 17. And we've lived through some pretty tough deals, you know. Cheap calves and high price feed and just the other way around, you know. We've had the high price calves and cheap feed. But we have very few real good years as far as income years and a lot more tougher years. You just barely slink by, you know. It's pretty tough. But it's not just us, you know.
Yeah.
If the drought affects me, sooner or later it's going to affect you. It might not today or tomorrow, but in the long run it will, you know. How should I say it? Everything trickles downhill. It hits me first, but sooner or later it's going to hit somebody else.
That's Royce Larson. He's a rancher in Park Valley, Utah. And he's right. The drought is already hitting rural communities in the state hard. Take Oakley. City officials there have imposed a temporary building moratorium because of the drought. Earlier this week, we spoke with Jack Healy, a reporter for the New York Times who's been covering the story. And Healy told us what's happening in Oakley could be a sign of things to come for cities in the West.
One of the things that makes these small towns important is that they tend to be a little bit more vulnerable to like the effects of drought and water supply than big cities like Denver, where I am, or Salt Lake, where you are, you know, or even like desert cities, you know, in Arizona, because they don't have the same level of water rights and they don't have the same kind of resources to go out and either acquire more water or drill for it, you know, when things get dire. Even though Oakley is really small, it's got 17,000 people and change. I thought that what it was going through, yeah, I mean, could be sort of like a harbinger. And that's when I decided to give the mayor a call and see about coming out for a few days to just kind of get a sense of what the lack of water meant for them on a day-to-day basis.
So you mention in your piece the mayor of Oakley, a man by the name of Wade Wolstenhume. Tell us about him. He races horses. He judges rodeos. He's a local.
Yeah. Not just a local, but a multi-generational local. Yeah. You know, a lot of the folks in town can still trace different branches of their families back to the pioneers who were some of the first white settlers in the area in the 1800s. And you know, Wade's one of those guys. As we were wandering around town, kind of surveying what the fields were looking like and the river, you know, Wade was talking about his whole family history and the different branches that just like extend as far back as sort of the town really exists. And he is rounding out his second term as mayor. And this sort of grappling with the drought, I think in some ways is kind of like, you know, one of the most significant challenges that he's faced. And I think in some ways that it'll probably be sort of like his legacy as the mayor of this little town where, you know, he grew up and raised his family.
Yeah. I shouldn't make assumptions, but I would guess he's conservative politically.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a pretty conservative guy. And when we talked about climate change and government and stuff like that, in the context of this drought, you know, the mayor had, you know, definitely sort of like a more sort of skeptical view of the effects of, you know, human caused emissions on, you know, the warming and drying out of the climate, you know, which of course scientists have pretty demonstrably shown that the climate is warming and that we're the ones responsible for it. I mean, you know, Wade's perspective was rooted in sort of a more conservative view, but also in faith and, you know,
Latter-day Saint, I guess, right?
You know, I actually didn't ask him what his particular faith was.
That's another assumption I shouldn't make, but it's a hunch.
Yeah. Potentially. Yeah. That was his family background, sure. But we didn't get into particular discussions of his faith.
But faith was important.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he said that, you know, I mean, he sort of really believed that, you know, God was in control of both sort of life in general, but also of climate, and that ultimately, you know, there would be a way that God would provide for people in this sort of difficult and changing world. So all of this, these conversations all happened as we were kind of exploring the town, and he was showing me sort of where they drew their water from and what had happened this spring that caused it so much concern that they decided to actually stop building.
Well, tell me about that moment, how the moratorium comes to be. Did he have, the mayor and others, a particular moment of, you know, of revelation that made them think we need to do something?
You know, drought is a really slow moving disaster, right? Yeah. And I think it sort of happened bit by bit. There was last year when we just didn't get the summer rains that often come. And then there was the winter where the snowpack levels were, you know, not horrible in Utah, but also not sufficient to, you know, rebuild the levels of soil moisture that were needed. This spring, you know, the runoff just wasn't there. And that is all kind of built into what's happening with the climate. As the snowpack becomes more uneven, as snow melt happens earlier, and as like the soils are hotter and drier, you know, the ground is just soaking up so much more water, and it's not making its way into the rivers and the reservoirs anymore. And so Oakley has had a couple of sources of water. There is a deep well, and there are a couple of springs. And one of the springs slowed down its production this spring, slowed down to about 15 gallons a minute. And just to give you sort of a sense of like what that means, I live actually on a little piece of land, and I have a well at my house. And for my house, this well produces about 10 gallons a minute for just me and my family. And so, I mean, 15 gallons a minute for a town of 1,700 people, plus their other supplies, they were just sort of seeing the writing on the wall that they were going to really get into a water crunch. The town uses at sort of peak watering in the summer about 800 gallons a minute. However, they were running at about 500 gallons a minute in supply. And obviously that's a big deficit, and they had to figure out something to do.
So what was the decision? How does the building moratorium come to be? How does it play out?
So towns and cities that are grappling with these water shortages, it's almost like they have like a spigot and they sort of try to turn it off bit by bit. So the first thing that they did was they passed some restrictions on outdoor water features, you know, like ponds or fountains or, you know, these kind of elaborate uses of outdoor water that are becoming more and more prevalent in the nicer new homes that are being built. So they passed some restrictions on those because those are huge water sucks. And then in May, they passed this construction moratorium, because they just thought, we really need to do something that is significant, that also sends a message to the people here that we are going to try to protect their water. And so the construction moratorium basically just says, you can't build any houses for the next 6 months that are going to have a hookup to the town's water supply. If you have your own well, or something like that, or if you just don't want water or something, then, you know, that's one thing. Yeah, right. Yeah. But for anybody who actually does want water, no way. They had to allow a couple of projects that were sort of approved, but not started to kind of get grandfathered in. But there are other projects that are just sort of on hold right now.
Talk about how this is playing out in other parts of the country. Maybe there aren't building moratoriums yet, but this kind of conversation, it seems to me, is starting to happen in all kinds of different places. Say a little bit about what else you're seeing in the West.
There are some parts of California where there are similar building moratoriums in place. There are places that are making developers, like in Arizona, for example, there are towns and government agencies that are telling developers, you cannot build on raw land unless you can prove to us that you have enough water to supply these homes for a century. And then, of course, there, during this immediate drought, a lot of places are trying to rethink how they use water and really whether things like Kentucky bluegrass should even belong in the West. You know, grass is incredibly thirsty, and it is also pretty useless for a lot of places. Las Vegas, it has banned ornamental grass, you know, on things like concrete medians or places where you don't use it. You know, if it's in a park, it's okay. But if it's just sitting on the side of a road, you know, for show, why water it? Why waste all of those resources? Mm-hmm. One of the other things that's happening is farmers and ranchers are really finding themselves at the forefront of the drought because they are finding that they get fewer days of irrigation than they normally would. Mm-hmm. And their water is sort of their access to irrigation water that they use to water their livestock or to raise grass to feed their livestock. It's getting cut off much earlier in the year than it normally would. And so this is really pinching ranchers this mm-hmm. year. So they're trying to conserve, but you know, you still have to feed, you know, the cows and the horses and the sheep.
Jack, of course, all of this is taking place, as you mentioned in your article, as real estate housing prices are going through the roof. There's a boom going on. One of the things you point out in your piece is that, this is how you put it, cheap housing is even scarcer than water in places like Utah. Talk about that dynamic. So aside from the fact that there's a drought, cities in the West, particularly in Utah, they're facing that affordability crisis for housing. So limiting the building of houses is just going to make that even worse, it seems.
Yeah. And what's happening in Oakley is obviously just such a tiny little piece of the puzzle, because so much of the demand for housing, as you know, is, you know, all up and down the Salt Lake Valley. But one of the things that is, I think, both frustrating for potential newcomers, but in some ways gratifying for current residents, are these moratoriums may have the effect of kind of keeping property values high. I heard from more than one person I was chatting with who already owned property in town that they had little problem with the moratorium because it would make their house more valuable, they thought.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's... And cities do not want to do this. They don't want to choke off growth. They don't want to stop building because growth is really like the lifeblood of the West, of tax revenue, mm-hmm. of, you know, money for businesses and local economies. And I think there's a real concern about the perception of places not having the capacity to grow, because every city is constantly trying to attract new businesses and new residents. And one of the reasons I think that cities are really reluctant to embrace a more draconian measure like these moratoriums is that it sends this message that, hey, there's no room at the inn. Mm-hmm. And I think they really fear the economic effects of that, you know, 5 years or 10 years out, if businesses just scratch off, you know, some city on their list of potential places to move because they don't think there's water there sufficiently to support them.
Mm. You know, it leads me to this question finally, because it seems like we have been warned in the West. You know, John Wesley Powell talked about how the growth of the West is going to be limited by water. And, you know, Wallace Stegner, he wrote about, you know, what he described as that arrogant belief that we can conquer aridity, that, you know, we can remake the region. Brigham Young talked about making the desert blossom as a rose. Mm. But it seems like that actual limitation of growth hasn't really happened. But maybe it will now. That seems like we're in a really interesting, unique time then.
You know, every time when I drive around and visit new communities, anytime I see a green lawn and I see landscaping, I just think like, hey, there's still some elasticity in the system, right? Like we can rip up all those lawns. We can use water in smarter ways to try to conserve. I don't know. I do think that like cities and rural areas are developing really smart uses to reuse water, to try to recharge aquifers, that there's a lot of really brilliant innovation happening all across the West. But at the same time, there's also just an incredible amount of water waste and a lot of really dumb use. And I think that at this point, even California, right, as bad as the drought is there, the state has not yet called for mandatory water cutbacks this time around, like they did, I think it was in 2014 when the drought was really terrible. And so there's a lot of debate right now over whether we in the West are really taking this seriously enough. You know, governments need to do more to mandate conservation, or whether the efforts to just encourage it are sufficient. And that really gets into, you know, bigger questions about the role of government and the role of personal freedom that you mentioned, and sort of who we are. You know, it's kind of funny that so many people out here have embraced lawns when they're just not natural features of the West. I mean, listen, give me, you know, yucca plants and Palo Verde any day. But
yeah. Jack Healy, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Jack Healy, he covers rural places for the New York Times. He's based in Colorado. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Some final thoughts now on drought, and we're going to turn to a climate scientist for a perspective on where we are. William Anderegg is an associate professor of biological sciences at the University of Utah. Now, there are extreme and exceptional droughts, droughts that come and go, but then there are mega droughts. And we learned in the first part of our series about some of the mega droughts in history, and that's where we began with Dr. Anderegg. Is this drought, this one, a mega drought?
We are in a mega drought. This is a multi-decadal drought that really kicked off at the end of the 90s. And it's, you know, a couple scientific studies have really suggested this is on par with a number of the mega droughts that have happened in the past 1,000 years, that it's pretty similar to the drought in the 1100s and, mm-hmm. and getting close to the drought, the mega drought in the 1500s.
So put this one in perspective. How bad is it compared to some of the others we're seeing?
This is really in the top five droughts in the past 1,000 years that we know from these tree ring records going back in time.
Wow.
This is probably about number two right now, although it can kind of bounce around pretty close to number one.
When did it begin, this one, as far as you can tell?
You know, the long-term drying starts around 98 to 2000, and there was a very severe short drought period around 2002-2003. That's when we start to see some of the biggest impacts play out on the landscape in terms of forests and fires and things like that.
How much of this is our fault? That seems like the crucial question.
Well, so in terms of severity of the current mega drought, human-caused climate change is about half of that severity. So what we know is that basically climate change has taken a pretty modest or moderate drought to a very, very severe drought.
So I wondered what the transformation, what the changes are going to be like for something like this. Let's say there's a decent water year next year. Like, oh, there's snowpack and it looks pretty good. How much of that water is going to be taken up by these incredibly dry soils? And because it just seems like we're in this cycle that if something doesn't change, it can get worse and worse and worse. Am I overstating it?
Well, so, I mean, a couple of really wet years could help us out somewhat. But yeah, it's true. I mean, our reservoirs are low, our soils are incredibly dry, and we're really drawing down a lot of that deep water and aquifers and, you know, subsurface storage. And that takes a lot of time to recharge. And a single big wet year doesn't get us out of this mega drought. We're really talking about 5 to 10 years of high precipitation.
Can what we do right now make a difference for the intensity of these droughts in the future? Can we alter our behavior, change our policy in some way that could make a difference? Or is it, you know, because the question is always, sorry, we're past the tipping point. It's too late.
Absolutely, we can make a difference. This is, you know, especially the next 5 to 10 years is really the window of opportunity to tackle what the future looks like here in the Southwest. We've got to do really two things. First is really getting serious and tackle climate change as quickly as we can. And that's going to head off the really bad mega droughts that could develop in 30, 40 years from now.
Because they're coming if we don't change.
They're coming if we don't change. If we continue on a high carbon emissions trajectory, the studies that have suggested that the current mega drought could be more like the sort of average to wetter periods in the 2070s and 2080s, that this it could get a lot worse if we don't head off climate change. And then the second is really adapt and prepare for the new normal, that these are the water conditions we have. And how can we make our economy, our ecosystems, and you know, our state and the region really resilient to the water that we have?
Should Salt Lake City and Ogden and Provo and those cities along the Wasatch Front who do have foothills that have water, that are those cities, should they look more like Phoenix and Las Vegas? That is, ditch the lawns, people. Let's get real. Or do you know what I mean? Like what should we look like as a city, if you've thought about that?
I mean, I think we've got to be much more seriously considering that. How can we xeriscape and really reduce the amount of outdoor water use? And actually, this summer has really laid that bare. We've seen these brown grass everywhere we go. When and where can we replace that with very water efficient but still very, you know, pleasant outdoor landscaping? Cities throughout the Southwest are thinking about that. L.A., Las Vegas, Phoenix. We have a bit more water than them, but it's not, you know, I think we need to be thinking along those lines.
I know this is a question more for a social scientist than a climate scientist, but how is this going to change us, this experience, this drought? Or should it change us?
Well, so I think it has to be a wake-up call if we want to be proactive and prepare for the future that we have and continue to, you know, have a thriving region. It's my hope is that it'll remind us a little bit more that we need to pay attention to the landscapes that we live in and try to live within our means of water and energy. And I don't know. Maybe there's a possibility also that it could bring us together a little bit. I mean, we all are experiencing and going to experience some of these drought stresses in the coming years. And this is a common struggle that we're all going to have to grapple with in this region. And no town or you know, county or congressional district is really going to be immune to this.
I like that as a I like that you have can find a positive spin on all of this, because it seems pretty dire for people. And the idea of, you know, people in cities and communities, you know, hoarding water and fighting over water and judging and scolding each other, you're seeing the possibility that the good part of human nature could come out for us.
You know, fundamentally, these problems are all solvable. It's about the creativity, the innovation, and the will to get it done. And that will to get it done has got to transcend a lot of these, you know, squabbles that we've been having. And I think it's entirely possible in the next 5 to 10 years we could really find that creativity and innovation and will to make this happen.
Let me ask you finally, at a moment like this, or reflect back a couple of weeks ago when it was 105 or 107 or whatever it was, because it was both of those. Do you feel as a climate scientist and as a someone who lives here, do you – because I'm guessing you go back and forth between feeling not hopeless but a little pessimistic and then maybe the moments of – what you sound like right now, somewhat optimistic that we can rally. Where are you right now?
You know, funny enough, the air quality and the smoke in the air has for me personally, has a pretty big impact on whether I am feeling like there's whether I have more optimism or,
yeah, me
or
too.
More pessimism.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly reading the science and looking at the potential futures can certainly get me depressed and down some days. I think where I see a huge amount of optimism is thinking about this as an opportunity to really create a prosperous and sustainable future here in the Southwest, and interacting with a lot of the students that I do as a professor, and really seeing that, you know, these young people, they get it, they're concerned, and they're fired up, and they really want to make sure that we solve these problems. Those are the things that I think bring me a lot more hope for the future.
Yeah. Well, Professor Anderegg, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
William Anderegg, he's an associate professor of biological sciences at the University of Utah. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.